Sir Peter Cosgrove, who is a decorated military commander, once said in a TV interview, "By any analysis, war is a stupid way of doing things." And today I want to explore what a Christian response to war could be. And it's particularly pertinent today, given that yesterday, as you well know, was the 100-year commemoration, 100-year anniversary of the Gallipoli landing. And I want to start by showing a film clip from Gallipoli, the film, Peter Weir's film Gallipoli, and you may well be familiar with it. It was a film that was released in the early 80s, and I'm going to play a scene that's somewhat of a disturbing scene. And I guess initially when I looked at it, I was unsure whether I was going to show it or not, but then I thought, no, I am going to show it because it demonstrates in a very powerful way both the futility of war and also the incredible bravery of those diggers 100 years ago. So, Neil, if we could go to that clip now, thank you.
We go ahead, as planned.
Day has become the most sacred day in our national calendar. In many ways, the week leading up to Anzac Day is our society's holy week, where we honour those fallen heroes, where we give thanks for those who gave up their own lives in sacrifice. And while I believe this commemoration of Anzac Day is a right and an honourable thing to do, there does sit for us who are Christians an uneasy tension. Should we honour anything to do with war when clearly war is not something that Jesus honours? On the night that Jesus was betrayed, one of his disciples attempted to take up arms. We hear about this story, or we can read about it in John chapter 18, and we discover that Peter, who was with Jesus as he was being arrested, had on his possession a sword. And he used it in an attempt to inflict some damage and he struck out at a man called Malchus, who was the servant of the high priest. Now, Peter's aim was not that good, and as a result, he only succeeded in slicing off the ear of Malchus. But Jesus' response to Peter is really interesting. In John chapter 18, he rebukes Peter. He tells him to put the sword away. And subsequent to that, he heals Malchus's ear. Now, it's just one story, but throughout the Gospels, the message is clear. Jesus gives no endorsement, no precedence for taking up arms in military conflict. His teachings overwhelmingly point to peace and a renunciation of war. And so as Christians and followers of Jesus, where does that leave us on the day when our nation commemorates those who have gone and fought and fallen in war? Can we participate in honouring the fallen without compromising the gospel of Jesus, who is the Prince of Peace? Even within our own heritage of the Churches of Christ in Australia, this uneasy tension sits. And I want to tell you a couple of stories about some returned servicemen that have been significant figures within our history as the Churches of Christ. The first one is W.H.B. Palmer. And Neil, if we could have that first slide there. W.H.B. Palmer was known as Harry, and he landed at Gallipoli in 1915. He was quickly promoted to the role of lieutenant, but was struck down in the trenches at Gallipoli with typhoid. And so as a result, he was sent home and he was repatriated back to Australia and discharged as medically unfit in 1916. But he recovered, and so in 1918 he re-enlisted. And he ended up back on the Western Front, and he was involved in some of the bitter fighting in the Somme and at Flanders. His experiences of war awakened something within him spiritually, and upon his return to Australia in 1920, he became involved in the City Temple Church of Christ in Sydney. A very large church in those days, one that's no longer in existence today. Now, his involvement in this church continued for the next 20 years, until 1940, when at the start of World War II, the Axis powers were sweeping Europe, and so Harry enlists again. And he ends up in Greece, and he sees active service there, and it was there when Greece was captured by the German army. Harry survived. And he returned back to Australia again, and upon his return he resumed his association with the Church of Christ, and for the next 50 years in the various locations where he lived, he was involved in a number of different Churches of Christ communities in New South Wales. It included serving as the New South Wales Church of Christ president in 1961 and 1962. Harry lived into his 90s and he passed away in 1991. He was a man that was known for his gentleness, his kindness and his care for others. A few weeks before his death, Northside Community Church of Christ, of which he was then a member, named a refuge that it had built. And they called it the Palmer Peace House in honour of Harry. Now Harry was asked to recall, at one stage he was asked to recall his memories of Gallipoli, and he was one of these men that never really said very much about his war experience. But he is quoted as saying this, "Ah, the comradeship had to be experienced to be believed." Another story, one with a particular connection to our church, is the story of John Turner. And Neil, we can have that next slide, thanks. John Turner is the father of Jenny Forrest and Marg Danielik, who are members, long-term members of our church. Recently I sat down with Jenny and Marg and I got the opportunity to interview them, and we recorded this conversation that we had, and it was a really wonderful time where I asked them to recollect the ministry journey of their dad, because John Turner was the Church of Christ minister for many years, both before the war and subsequent to World War II. And the purpose of the interview was actually for the Church of Christ historical archives, because we're trying to record some of the oral histories that sit within our churches for the sake of potential research and study down the track. But we're also going to be making the recording of this available on our church's website soon if you're interested. And John Turner had a remarkable ministry journey, and the interview is well worth a listen when we do put it up on our site. But he ministered in all sorts of different ways, and including in this journey was that he spent 3 years as an army padre during World War II. It included overseas service in the Guadalcanal, and as a result of his service he came back very sick. He had a number of tropical diseases, and Jenny and Mark both say that he was never 100% well again, even though he lived into his late 70s, I think, yeah. Jenny tells the story of how when she was 6 years old, a man came to the door of her home and asked to come inside to see her mum. And the man was her dad. And he'd been away for so long, and because he was sick, his appearance had changed, and Jen didn't even recognise him. Now I'm a father of a 3-year-old daughter, the same age that Jen was when her father left to go to war. I can't even imagine that sacrifice alone of not seeing my kids for 3 years. In the interview, Jenny and Marg go on to describe the friendship that their dad established with other diggers. You've got to stop this. I've got to stop looking at my wife. Even years after the war, it was a common occurrence, as Jen and Marg would be out around town in Melbourne with their dad, for someone to yell out across the street, "Hey, Padre!" And their dad would always stop and have a chat. Now, there's just two stories that I share today, and there are many others. There's at least that we know of 4 Church of Christ ministers who served as army padres during World War I. Now I want to show the next photo if we can, Neil. What's really fascinating is that in spite of this involvement of Church of Christ ministers and leaders in theatres of war, it's also true that Church of Christ ministers and leaders were front and centre of anti-war protests. In World War I, World War II, and particularly as this photo demonstrates, amongst the anti-Vietnam War protests in the late 60s and early 70s. Church of Christ ministers actively advocating an anti-war position, moving against the direction that had been set by the government of the day. just from these few stories, it's clear that even within our own faith tradition, there's a lot of complexity in regards to how we should approach and then remember war. Now, it's a common sentiment that you hear, especially from anyone that's been involved or had actual involvement in war, for them to say that it's futile to reflect on what the words of Peter Grosgrove that I shared at the start of this message. By any analysis, war's a stupid thing to do. From the Gospels, we learn that Jesus confronted and he challenged the corrupt and the evil systems of the day without ever having to resort to violence. But he challenged and he confronted to such an extent that the authorities, those that were keen to protect their own patch, felt that they had no other option but to put him to death. They justified the sacrifice of one so that they could maintain the established way of doing things. They could maintain their status quo. And yet Jesus' death wasn't a result of circumstances that were beyond his control. He knew what was going to happen to him. And he knew why it needed to happen. As he healed the ear of Malchus, the high priest's servant, Jesus turned to Peter and he said these words, "Put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me?" You see, war's motivated by hate. Jesus chose to lay down his life because of love. On Monday night, on the Four Corners episode on the ABC, Chris Masters put together this really fascinating report that's well worth a look. You can get it on iView. And he compared and made the contrast of the experiences with the very first Anzacs that landed on Gallipoli with those that have fought in our most recent war that Australia's been involved in, that being Afghanistan. And one of the themes that came through, whether we're talking to diggers from Gallipoli or Afghanistan, was that once they were there, once they were in the theatre of war, it wasn't the idea of God, king or country that motivated them, but it was friendship. It was their mates. The preparedness to back each other, to endure together the hardship and the sacrifice. It was the strength of their friendship that motivated them. Now, they might have left to go to war with lofty ideals, but once they were there, once they were in the midst of battle, it was this value that kept them going. So why did Jesus have to die? Why did he choose this course? John 15, verse 3, he said this, "Greater love has no one than this, to lay down one's life for one's friend." Love. Love for his friends. Love for you. Love for me. Today, in the time that we've had, I've tried to explore some of this tension between recognising those that have sacrificed so much in war and yet also recognising that war ultimately is futile. That it's not the way of Jesus. And war in itself should not be glorified. Since I moved up to Gisborne 5 years ago, I've been to a number of our Anzac Day dawn services at Mount Macedon up on the cross, and I was there yesterday morning, bright and early. And what I've come to admire about these services is the brilliant way, and you have to go to understand this, the brilliant way in which the sacrifice is honoured, but war's futility is also explored. Now, a person who has been a long-term member of the Anzac Day Dawn Service Committee is Dr. Frank Donovan, who is here with us today. And Frank's also a war veteran, having seen service himself in Vietnam. And I want to ask Frank if he'd like to come forward now. And Kate, if you want to pass me that parcel too. I've got just thought, as a way of finishing our service today, I'd like to ask Frank a few questions around some of the I guess, the thinking and the motivation behind this service that happens, a wonderful community event that happens where, I'm not sure the exact numbers yesterday, Frank, but we were expecting something in the vicinity of 5,000 people, and it's a huge event. And the number of people from our, number of people from our community that turn up to this event is quite astounding. I think that's about right. So I just wanted to ask you a couple of questions. Yeah.
We always like to inflate the numbers, I guess. Frankly, our best estimate is somewhere around 2,500.
2,500. Well, it's still astounding.
We know that because those... How many people here went to the dawn service? Can I have a... Yeah. So when you were there, as you came in, you would have received a postcard with a picture on the front and the order of service on the back. And we did that so that you could then download the full program from the website. Not today, right, Austin? Tomorrow, maybe. But we had 2,000... We had two boxes of 2,100, making a total of 4,200. And we haven't done an accurate count yet, but we think we've got two-thirds of one box left. So that leaves us concluding about 2,500.
And you might be able to add a few more, Frank, given that not everyone may have taken the digit. I guess what I wanted to explore with you is this tone of both honour and humility that we see in our Anzac Dawn service. Why is that something that's important from your perspective?
Okay. You'd notice that we try to do three things up at the cross on Anzac Day. Obviously, we want to honour the sacrifice that people, 62,000 Australians, have made with their lives at war. Actually, more than 62 now with Afghanistan. We want to salute the service of those who went and gave themselves for whatever reason, and as you say, often with lofty ideals they went, sometimes less than lofty. An adventure was a common theme that recruited the early Anzacs, just as it was a common theme that recruited people like me in Vietnam. Having done that, we try to get people and we invite people from the outset of that service to learn something useful from all of that. And what's useful to learn, I think, well, there are a number of things that are useful to learn. But one of the most important things to learn from that, particularly with people there who are involved in politics, decision-making at all levels, is the urgent need to explore non-violent options for conflict resolution. That's probably the most pressing need the world has today. Not because the casualties that we hear about from Afghanistan and Iraq are great. They're not. Compared with the 62,000 lives lost in World War I. Of course they're not. But the capacity to destroy nations today is there, present, everywhere around the world. We don't live in a small arms fire war zone anymore. We live in a nuclear war zone. And that has much greater capacity and therefore magnifies the need, in my view. And it's not just mine, my committee shares this view. Austin, who's joined us this year, shares this view. It magnifies the need to get our political people, our academic people, our intellectuals, our manufacturers, our business people, our community leaders to explore non-violent ways of conflict resolution. That's the message of the Dawn Service at Mount Maston. How we portray that message is this. We focus most of our attention through those voices that you hear read on the human cost of war. That's where I think the mortar is that joins the bricks of the message of the importance of exploring non-violent methods of conflict resolution. Because today, and not just today, going back to World War I, those costs are profoundly huge at home, just as they are on the front. The difference, and this may offend some of you, the difference is this. On the front, it was over when they died and fell. At home, the costs go on and on through generations, as we found most notably with our Vietnam returnees, and as we're finding again with our Iraqi and Afghanistan returnees.
And for a group like ours, you know, 100 or so people that are here, and I'm thinking both in a collective sense and also in an individual sense, how can we best remember and honour those that have gone to war in the midst of the tension that we sit? What advice would you give us?
Well, Paul, I've got to say, I'm actually quite a friend of what you call uneasy tensions. Tensions generate change. The question is, which way will that change occur? I think to answer your question, you know, it kind of starts at home and then it goes out into the workplace and the schools. The tensions between what I want and what you want are sometimes, often, going to differ. How we both get our needs met is something we can negotiate. At home, that is where that needs to start. Between partners, between parents and children, between children. So, this might upset the football fans, but, you know, we seem, particularly in Western societies generally, and especially in our country, competition seems to be the value, the primary value, and we start them early. Let's get them into little aths. And when we get them into little aths, let's get down the track there and urge them on. They have to win. But of course, in a football match, there can only be one side that wins. And in a foot race, there can only be one person that wins. And in a swimming event, there can only be one person that wins. Someone has to lose. And so we, as Australians, seem to have this fantastic commitment to competition. At home, at school, in the workplace, in the community, I think we need to meet the challenge to shift some of that emphasis from competition over to cooperation. I've addressed both the high schools in our area the last week or so in Gisborne Secondary with a song, as usual, at Braemar College with a very short speech, similar to the one I made yesterday at Wood End. We need to... One lesson we can learn from those Anzacs, you know, Gallipoli was a disaster, everyone knows that, but they left us a legacy. What we came to admire about them was the way they conducted themselves. Paul referred to the primacy of mateship, and it was as true for them as it was for us in Vietnam. I think day two after we first went into operations in my battalion, we'd forgotten why we came to Vietnam. We were much more interested in looking after each other. So they left us a legacy, and the legacy I put to people this week is this: they behaved in battle as we people, not me people. And through our marketing, advertising, heavy promotion, retail therapy, and so on, our message in politics, in business, and in the marketplace is me. Pick up your computer screens, go to Google and click and write my. Click it and look at the number of my places that come up. My hair, my feet, my this, my that, my account. You've seen them all. The emphasis today in our world is on me. For this aspiration to shift from competition to cooperation as a route to non-violent conflict resolution, we have to learn again to become we people, as the Anzacs became.
That's very powerful. Thank you. Final question I have. Within our congregation here, a number of our families have extended family that have served in various fields of war in recent times. And I'm just interested to hear, how do we assuming for those of us that have family members that have been to war, how can we best support them on their return and in the subsequent years since?
Yes, well, that's the challenge of all ex-service communities, organisations, RSLs, Vietnam Veterans Associations, Peacekeepers and Peacemakers Associations, Department of Veterans Affairs and so on. And it's made particularly, and there's a song I want to do for you in a minute that I wrote in 2010. What makes it so difficult is that we're not easy people to deal with. We are just not easy people to deal with. We're sometimes embittered, often angry, often hostile. We don't want to talk about our experiences. We don't want you to ask us about our experiences. We want to push you away. It makes it very difficult. As Christians, and I'm one, I'm of the Catholic tradition, you're of the Church of Christ tradition, it doesn't really matter. The boss is the same. I think the most productive thing that Christians can do, at least, and encourage others to do, is to just open and listen sometimes and just bear with it. And at the end of a difficult time for a veteran who maybe is in psychiatric care, or maybe he's lost limbs, or she's lost limbs, by the way. We're in Afghanistan now, we have women on the front line there. Is to just be accepting of them, including their anger, which is very challenging to do. Something of a speciality of mine. I wrote a book about it 10 years ago. It's published here and in the US. It's very challenging. But it's the best I can do to answer that question, Paul.
Yeah. Thank you. it's been very good. And I actually, on behalf of our church, I think I just wanted to say to you our appreciation for the way in which you've been involved in that organising of the Dawn service over the past number of years. I think it's more than 10. You would be able to...
2003 I've joined and helped with the first one that I was involved in. From 2004 onwards I've been producing them, writing them. Yeah. And now, and this will just about clinch it I think, this year we recruited your Austin Van Groningen to our team, and he's kind of been my understudy. Yeah. You probably read in the Leader last week that I don't feel able to keep producing this. Yeah. And I said in that article through Natalie why I'm finding it more and more difficult. But Austin's very resourceful. He's a great researcher. And he's got the enthusiasm and the capacity. And I'm kind of hoping he'll take this role on. Aren't I?
That's great. Thanks, Austin. Terrific. Yeah, well done. I think some of the most moving moments for me personally at our Dawn services, and also last year I was fortunate enough to be at your sundowner dinner. And you sung there, and just to hear you sing, there's something that comes from very deep within there that is very powerful, and I've asked you to sing, and you're going to do that for us now, but just before you do, I actually have a gift to give you, which is, on behalf of Gisborne Church of Christ, just a thank you for your involvement in our Dawn service many years for, we just wanted to say thank you for what
that.
You've done, so... Can we
thank you,
Frank?
So much.
Now, I understand, Frank, that your library would be... I would expect that your library might be quite significant.
It doesn't have that one.
Oh, that's wonderful. I have... In there is a return voucher, just in case. So why don't you take us down and just share a bit about the song that you're going to sing, and then lead us away from there. Now, did you want the stand?
Music stand, yeah. In 2010, at the Dawn service, two students from Gisborne Secondary, among other students, were involved in presenting what we call our Voices from the Front. And I'd asked them if they could replay an interview that was conducted 2 years previously on, not on Four Corners, there was Four Corners. It involved a Vietnam veteran and his daughter. And so these students, 2 years later, on top of the mount, replayed the most essential elements of this interview between the Vietnam veteran and his daughter. And at the end of the interview, the Vietnam veteran says, "You know, it doesn't end there. It just bleeds on down." And I thought, what a powerful line for a song that certainly I could relate to, and I'm hoping you will. I might. Yeah, I might even need my glasses. Now, I never like to do things unrehearsed. This one is unrehearsed, I'm sorry. And it's been a long day yesterday. And my voice, as you can tell, is a bit croaky. But sleep still escapes me, 'cause that war it still plays on my mind. But must it prey too on my wife and our kids? Why can't it just stay with my kind? Home with your dads, not meant to be trauma. It's meant to be warm love and smiles. But I live at home with a bomb, says my daughter. He explodes and you hear him for miles. Oh, wars don't just finish, they never get done. There's a debt can't be paid by your country. When you send them to war, know before it's begun, it'll just bleed on down through the family. Much as I love my kids and my dear wife, there's feelings and dreams that still haunt me. It's a battle inside, raging on through my life. It ain't fair, this front line is my family. There are times, said my son, we kids button our lips. Not to you, Dad, 2 words dare we say. We just hold it all in till a frightened tear slips. Not a sound, or it's war we'll all pay. 'Cause wars don't just finish, they never get done. There's one debt can't be paid by your country. When you send them to war, know before it's begun, it'll just bleed on down through the family. Was it freedom we sought on that great western front? At Kokoda, Tobruk or Long Tan? In the snows of Korea, the sands of Iraq, or the highways of Afghanistan? We thought when it's done and we're safe back home, that our war we could leave far behind. But war ain't like that. It won't leave us alone. It just bleeds on at home in our minds. It just bleeds on down. It bleeds right on down. Right down through all of the family. When you send them to war, know before it's begun, it'll just bleed on down through their families. It'll just bleed on down through their families. lead on down through their families. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Okay. Let's finish in prayer. Lord, we want to thank you for those that have sacrificed so much, both for those that have gone off to wars and where that was the end for them, but also for those that have gone and returned, but the war has not finished for them. Lord, we thank you for the values that are just so obvious and shine through so brilliantly around what does it mean to be Australian, these values of mateship, of loyalty, of humour in the face of adversity, of sacrifice, bravery, courage. And even though there sits this uneasy tension as to how we are to view war, we can still reflect on the values. The values that have the fingerprints of you all over them. And Lord, as we go out today, may we know your peace and may we know your presence with us. No matter what our experiences, no matter what sits there in our family life, help us to live in such a way that honours those values and in doing so honours you. Lord, we thank you for the fact that you did willingly go to the cross, that you sacrificed in order that we may have life, both life now and life forever. And as we go out today, I pray that we can each and every one of us embrace the full life that is available in you, Lord. I pray this in Jesus' precious name. Amen.